Hello, this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Manton Rees.
And this is Core Intuition, a snapshot in time.
On December 20th, 2006, at 6 p.m., I was running.
On January 19th, at 12:20 p.m., I was launching my Twitter lifestyle. These little strolls down memory lane brought to you by Old Tweets, which is not a sponsor of the show, but just a cool little tool we found online that actually lets you go back, assuming you have been somewhat prolific in your Twitter use over the years and exceeded that 3,200. That's the number, right, Manton?
Mm-hmm.
3,200 yep. Tweets limit on what you can search on your own archives. Then and you happened to be a member of Twitter during its first year, then if you go to Kellan, kellan.io/oldtweets, you will find a cool little tool that will let you search all of your tweets from day one. So as it happened, I started, as I said, on January 19th, 2007, and it has like 384 tweets, so I didn't waste any time. Manton, I started quite a bit later than you did, it looks like, but I guess I was already running my mouth.
I didn't tweet. Actually, I think I tweeted more often back then. They were bland, sort of boring kind of tweets, but they were actually kind of more interesting in some ways than the modern Twitter. It's very old. Twitter is clean. There's not a lot of replies. It's quiet. It's quite different than today's timeline, which is just you're following hundreds of people and quite different. It's nice to look back.
Yeah. It's kind of charming and embarrassing at the same time.
Right.
Like most nostalgic things. I noticed that my style back then in the beginning was very much like, sentence fragments like you would type in IRC or like on a mud,
right?
When you say like slash me is having a fun time, you know?
Yeah.
One of the charming things about these old tweets is that I think that, for many of us, they are written in a tone and, with a sort of like unpretentiousness and lack of care that goes with, for all of us, having very few followers back then, right? It was not a big deal. Not to say that it's a huge deal what you write in your Twitter now, but I think that for most of us, understand that like there's this culture that's come out of Twitter where now it's like there's more of an expectation that a tweet be somehow worthwhile.
Has to be important or hilarious or something. Yeah, but it's funny. I've been thinking about this lately with my blog too, trying to get back in the habit of blogging. And I look back on old blog posts and I really loved them more in some ways than some of the stuff I write now, exactly for the reason you were saying. It's like when you write as if no one's listening or reading what you have to say, you can just kind of, I don't know, it frees you up a little bit. And when you think that, oh, I've got all these people listening and, you know, reading what I have to say, you kind of sometimes panic and like, oh, okay, this has to be perfect. And I'd love to get back to the old state of mind where I just write what I need to write. And that's what it is. If you want to listen, great. If not, that's okay too. Cause I think it's more, I don't know, it's more honest and more, genuine in some ways. And it allows me to actually write more, which, would be a good thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting you said that because I can't help but think about our own show, the Core Intuition, the show we are speaking to everybody on now. And, you know, since we started taking the sponsorships, it's been great that we're recording every week. I mean, we've been recording every week, and I think we've been really doing a great job keeping our, you know, tone and probably improving the tone in some ways. At least that's what I like to think. But it's at the back of my mind, I'm still sometimes worried about the kind of stuff you're talking about. Like now that there is a rule, there are rules involved now, right? Like before we were just jab, jab, jab. And we'll spit this stuff out to the world. And if they want to listen, that's fine. And if they don't, that's fine. And it's still more or less that way. But you know, you and I have agreed that we're going to do this more or less on a weekly basis, and we have a commitment to, like, people who are giving us money to not be total jerkwads about it, right? So it's just kind of something that's interesting. I'm kind of intrigued now to go back and listen to some of the early shows, because it's been so long, I probably almost completely forget, like, some of the early shows we did. I was talking to a friend at Cocoa Heads just a few days ago, and he, first of all, he shamed himself by confessing to me that he has never listened to Core Intuition. Mm-hmm. And once I got through, you know, crying, he brought it up on his iPhone, and he scrolled down to like episode 6 or something. I don't know what it was. No, it was something early enough that it was like on the eve of the iPad being released or something, you know. And I just thought, that's kind of, you know, this is our own little personal, like, scrapbook album in some ways, for us to go back in and review, kind of like we were reviewing these old tweets. So
yeah, totally. It's great to have the archive of shows, and I think, you know, some of them probably hold up pretty well, and some of them maybe are not exactly timely anymore, but I think it's been consistent, which I like. I think the show's been pretty consistent overall.
So this this old tweets thing is kind of pertinent to your, you know, areas of expertise, because one of the jobs of Tweet Library is to, and Tweet Marker for that matter, is to go go back and try to get as many of your old tweets as possible and keep them kicking around so you can reference them and search them, etc. It's sort of been well known that this 3,200 limit means you basically have no luck of finding your own old tweets unless you happened to be forward-thinking enough at the time to start archiving them.
Right. And I was fairly forward-thinking, so I actually did have an archive of all these already. But this is such a great little app, and I am very jealous that I did not come up with the idea myself to integrate into Tweet Library or Tweet Marker, because it's just brilliant. I mean, you wouldn't think that he has basically crawled, you know, the first year of tweets just one by one. And so he has everything, you know, he had a blog post about this, which we can link to, but he was basically saying he wanted his old ones. And I guess by the time he realized he wanted them, it was too late to use something like Tweet Library or another app to go back and get them. So the only way he could get his own tweets was to just get all tweets from the first year. And so he's very clever about the way he did this. And yeah, like I said, I wish I had done it myself because it would make a great feature in my apps for people that were around in Twitter's early days.
Yeah. Definitely. We'll link to the blog post. It's really interesting. Some of this, one of the things I noticed he did is, like, he had to figure out, because there's like something like the number space for the first year for tweet IDs was something like 20 million. Right. Mm-hmm. And then he calculated that with like the API limits and all that, that he would take him like, I don't know,
15 years
to get. So obviously that did not happen. It sort of still baffles the mind how he figured it out, and he doesn't go into quite as much detail as one might hope, but it's still interesting that he managed to kind of crack this puzzle.
Oh yeah.
And but on a similar note, this will be particularly pertinent to people like in the UK, and possibly throughout Europe, because I tweeted about this old tweets thing, and then a Twitter user, Luke Redpath, let me know about a situation in the UK, at least, where I guess because of something called the UK Data Protection Act, Twitter is legally obliged to send at least UK citizens a copy of all of the quote information they have saved on their behalf about them, something like that. Not quote, I should have said to send, paraphrase. But what's interesting about that is, you know, most of us, at least in the US, have just sort of resigned that we, you know, it's at Twitter's discretion whether they'll ever open up their archives and make it easier for us to get access to our own old stuff. But apparently, depending on the country you live in, you may actually have a situation where Twitter is obliged to do this. And for the UK, I think it's been made simple enough that you can like go to a web page and ask for them. So I have a link. I have another link I'll put in the show notes for folks listening who happen to be lucky enough to live in a country where they can do that.
Yeah, I've had in my feature database for a while now, actually, to support importing these files. It says that when you request this, if you're in the, I guess, is it all of Europe, I guess? Or is it just
the
UK?
Uncertain. Maybe we could, we better not say now, because that would be like speculating about Microsoft Surface.
Right, exactly. But it, when you request this thing, it's not completely automated. Like, I believe it takes a few days to get a response, but you get back, you know, you get back like text files that have, you know, all your replies, all your tweets, all, whatever. I don't know how they break it down, but you get like certain files that have these things in them. And so I'd love in Tweet Library or TweetMarker for that, TweetMarker Plus for that matter, to just support importing these. So for people who have gotten them, you know, you can load them up, and Tweet Library would be smart about just merging that with whatever it already has. And so I think on Twitter's side, they must have like some button someone can press, right? That's like, for this account, you know, export everything. It's going to take a little while, but then it'll email the files off. But it's not the kind of thing, apparently, that they care about making completely self-service for everyone, just because there'd be a cost in going back and generating it. So it seems it's still kind of a hassle to get it, but certainly they have it automated enough where they can press a button. And, you know, one day maybe they'll care again about old tweets and make it easier to get this stuff, because it's all there.
Yeah.
They're so focused on, you know, the real time stuff and search and ads and what's happening right now that they just, it's not on their radar to think about old stuff.
Right. Well, one concern I have, I mean, let's be honest. My old tweets are, you know, it's not like Smithsonian material, so it's not, it's not going to be the end of civilization if like Twitter deletes them. But one thing that, you know, it sort of makes me wonder, like, let's say that this is only in the UK, and then let's say, okay, it spreads to the EU, and then it spreads to, like, the United States has a similar law, and then suddenly Twitter decides, you know what, screw this, this is too much work. We can also get around this by simply not maintaining that data anymore, and then switching to a purely sort of like real-time service. It doesn't seem like they would do that.
I don't think they'll do that, because I don't think the storage cost is that much for the old stuff. I think it's more of accessing it fast, because like for like building your timeline and all that kind of thing, it's heavily cached. They've got all sorts of stuff in memory. They've got thousands of servers, but old stuff may be slower to access. Yeah. It's on disk somewhere. But I'll tell you what, if they did that, I'd be done. I wouldn't use Twitter anymore, because I really, you know, like we joke about our old tweets, but although some, even the first 5 or 10 tweets, some of that stuff still applies today. Like one of mine was, you know, launching Xcode or doing something. Some of that hasn't changed much, but there are some tweets that I really love looking back and seeing a snapshot in time of like what I was doing. Especially I used to tweet about family stuff a little more and, you know, stuff that was happening just in general, travel, conferences, you know, kids, whatever. So I love that stuff. And if Twitter ever cut that off, I would definitely move on and do something else, because I think there's a lot of value in keeping those.
Okay. Well, speaking of things that are primarily of benefit to citizens of the UK and Europe, we are really happy to have back as our sponsor this week, iDeveloper TV and NS Conference. Manton, take it away.
The guys at iDeveloper TV are holding a new type of one-day conference in the UK called NS Conference Mini. The conference is made up of multiple sessions on just one subject in one day. The first NS Conference Mini is the 17th of September and is looking at how developers and designers need to coexist and work together throughout the app development process. The world-class speakers are Jamie Newberry, Dave Wiskus, Matt Gemmel, Josh Clark, and Kathy Shive. You can find all the details at iDeveloper.tv/core-mini.
Wow, what a great idea. I love this because, first of all, as you know, Manton, we've talked about this before, I love single track conferences where you know that you are not going to miss something by being in the wrong room at the wrong time. And this just sounds like a great, like, concentrated... You know what it reminds me of is the Apple Developer Tech Talks.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Ironically, or, you know, after having said I like single track, you know, those tech talks were not single track, but it was great how they were just one day of like concentrated goodness.
And also, unlike those, this one has a specific theme, which I love.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and it's a broad enough theme where there's a lot of variety in it, but there's definitely a theme and it'll tie the talks together, you know.
And it's a theme that, you know, the whole design approach, it's one that I think more developers need to tune into. And it's one that Scotty has actually addressed, you know, in the past at the NS conference proper. But this is just great to have one mini conference devoted to this topic of developers and design working together happily forever after. So thanks again, Scotty. This is wonderful. Thanks for the sponsorship for the second time. And I hope that bunch of folks in Europe and the UK get a chance to check out this conference on the 17th of September.
Yep. Thanks again for sponsoring. It's iDeveloper.tv/CoreMini and sign up for that. And while you're there, check out the videos too. We talked about last time, a couple weeks ago, some great video packs and videos from previous NS conference. So I started a new project last week, a web project, and I wanted something that I could just work on the iPad. And this has been a kind of a fun experiment. I know we talk sometimes about, you know, you need Mars Edit for iPad and different apps for iPad and whatnot, but actually forcing yourself to work on something on just the iPad is really interesting to see what's there and what's not. And so far, going well. You know, I mean, you can't really do this for Mac and iOS development, but for web development, I think it works. When you can SSH into servers, you can work on Ruby or Python or PHP code or whatever and upload things.
So what are you using as like a, what's your IDE, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, I haven't settled on just one. I am using a combination of Panix Diet Coda,
uh-huh,
which is excellent. And I'm also using Textastic, which is also really good. It's been around for a little while. I kind of feel like I need both of those. Panix is really great UI, really great for editing things on the server, but it doesn't have local storage on the iPad. So if you're offline, and so I'm using Textastic for local stuff and also for Dropbox sync. So the project is on Dropbox and I can sync files that way. And then I can also edit with Diet Coda on the server, or I can SSH files over. And I'm also still using Panic's other product, Prompt, the SSH client. Even though it's built into Diet Coda, I like kind of having it separate still for something. So this is on EC2, and so I can SSH into the instances and I can make changes. And the EC2's web interface, I was really happy to see, also completely works in mobile Safari. So you can set up instances, take servers down, all that kind of stuff actually works on the iPad. It's pretty nice.
That's cool. You know, it seems like the iPad should be good for some of these kinds of development that are very, like, you know, not necessarily super like graphics and like interaction intensive. You obviously can't debug like an app with on the Mac that you're building with drag and drop. Although I've sort of wondered sometimes if, you know, you sort of theoretically can do anything with the iPad if you say used a VNC client or something like screens.
Yep.
But when I've used screens, just kind of playing around with it, it begged the question to me, like, well, I wonder if it would be cool to have like task specific VNC. You know, like what if you had like remote Xcode that was just like tuned for like writing in Xcode and testing the results. And I don't know if that's worth the trouble really, but sometimes I think like, oh, it would be nice if I could just sit here and hack on my such and such, you know, my JavaScript code in Mars Edit, let's say, and see the results. But so far I haven't really done anything as ambitious as you with the idea of doing an iPad only development project.
Yeah, I wanted, you know, it's slower. It's a slower development process than on the Mac with a keyboard and a mouse and everything. But I really wanted something that I could do when I just had my iPad and I was somewhere else. And so even though it's slower kind of switching between apps and copying and pasting text around and syncing and whatever, the fact that I can do it if I'm away from my computer makes up for that limitation, I guess. But yeah, I'm going to go through the whole process and see how it goes. I'm trying this app is small enough where I'm trying to do it completely on the iPad. I like what you're saying about specific VNC clients almost. And I think the best like SSH clients and text editors and whatnot are they're similar in that they do add commands that make sense for where you are. So whether that's so like when you're SSHing in to something, they add stuff to the keyboard that makes sense.
Right.
So like a tab key right there, escape key right there at the top, you know, so they add stuff that, that makes sense in the context of working in the bash shell or whatever.
Right.
And so I could see that taking to other apps as well. Cause obviously if you were going into your Mac remotely and doing something like Xcode or some other app, there would be a dozen different commands that you wouldn't normally need when you're just using any app from VNC, but for that specific app would make sense.
Totally. Well, that's cool. You know, I have to admit, I still don't use my iPad for all that much, and it's probably in some subtle and not so subtle ways responsible for the slowness of my own iPad development. You know, it's funny. I actually use my iPhone quite a bit. Even though I use my iPhone quite a bit, there's still no version of Mars Edit for iOS, but
yeah, I think, and that's kind of why I brought it up too. I think you have to force yourself to do that before you realize what's missing. Like you always blog from your Mac, so you don't feel the pain as much of like needing to post something or sync a draft or something from iOS. But if you ever get trapped or you force yourself to be trapped to only write a blog post from your phone or your iPad, I think then you'll see where the where the process breaks down.
And I had a preview of that kind of lifestyle when my computer had to go into the shop to the Apple store for a few days. And of course, the first thing I did was like cobble together another computer from like spare parts and like a potato and a hot dog and like, copper wire. But my Mr. Wizard computer.
You would rather use a potato and some wire and some MacGyver parts than like just get your iPad.
Meanwhile, I've got two shiny iPads here. But yeah, it was like, oh man, it would be nice if I had Mars Edit for the iPad right now. And it would be nice if, I remember it was a day that we were trying to put a Core Intuition episode live. And I was like, I was not even like, I think I was texting you because I was like so desperate. I was like, message from Daniel. I have no computer. Please send help. Yeah. And I was like, you know, Manton, it's okay. Just release the episode. But yeah. it would have been nice if that was an example of a time where it would be nice if I had invested in more of my like online essentials being set up on an iPad or something like that. So maybe that's what I need. Maybe I need to have like iPad Thursday.
Yeah, you know? There you go. Like, yeah, I like that.
I don't know. It's an idea.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to take a question. As a reminder to anybody listening, we'd love to have your questions. It really helps spark thoughtful conversations here when we've run out of anything to talk about. This week's question comes from Richard Myers, who asks, I've heard a lot of independent single-employee companies refer to themselves in marketing copy as we. When asked about it, they almost always say it makes them seem like a bigger, more legitimate company. I feel like that has its advantages, I suppose, but one of the cool things about being an indie developer is that you do it all yourself. We should be proud. What do you guys do and why? What about you, Manton? Are you a royal we aficionado, or do you go for the more lone wolf approach?
I always do I. I gave this some thought a while back and decided I'm just going to be very consistent. I always say I. And I say it, first of all, because it's true. It's just me. There's nobody else. And I don't want to, I don't want to misrepresent that there's like a team of 20 people. But also, I think I love that personal connection with people. Like one of the advantages to running your own show is that, you can email directly with your customers and, you can be, in theory, more responsive to them instead of having like layers of people that between the developer and the person using the product. So I always say I like that it sort of reinforces that, personal relationship with the user. And, technically, people who have a single person company, we got designers on contract or other people. You could get away with saying we And, you know, and some people do have half-time or full-time employees. And then in that case, we makes a lot more sense. But for me, I really like I'm really consistent about it. And in marketing copy or press releases or whatever, if I write something that just sounds or feels wrong with I, I'll just rewrite it to avoid the issue. So rewrite it with the company name instead of we. So you can kind of mix words around a little bit so that it feels right without actually drawing attention to the I or the we.
You ever do the Bob Dole, the Riverfold software doesn't talk about Riverfold software.
Yeah. And it's always a little awkward too with press release type marketing stuff where you mention your own name or like when you have a quote from yourself and you wrote it,
Riverfold software founder Manton Reese was asked, yeah, do you think this new software is great? Why, yes, I do. Right.
So what about you? What do you do?
Well, we here at Red Sweater Software have a somewhat conflicted approach, which is that, yes, I do almost always adopt the royal we on behalf of the company because... in its own way, I feel like it just doesn't make sense for this thing called Red Sweater Software LLC to say I. So when I'm speaking in marketing copy, you know, on behalf of the company, you know, the descriptions of what Red Sweater Software is, you know, on the homepage for Red Sweater Software, it says about us. And then when you get into there, it says, you know, just Daniel Jalkut founded Red Sweater Software. However, as most listeners probably know, I represent my company very transparently. You know, I make no secret of the fact that it's me behind the company. I tweet about my company news in a very personal and proud way. But and I'm very sensitive to I have actually different rules for Red Sweater Software, but then also I have an account, for example, for Mars Edit, and Mars Edit is an unusual beast in that it speaks neither for the company or for me. So it has I have to adopt a sort of a different rule with Mars Edit. People will sometimes ask Mars Edit for like tech support, right? I'll say at Mars Edit, I'm having trouble setting up my blog. Can you help? And the problem there is Mars Edit's personality does not enable it to help customers.
Right.
So what will happen is Red Sweater comes in, swoops in, and replies to the tweet instead, usually.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Sometimes Mars Edit will say something snarky like, no, I can't do that, and it's because, you know, my developer Daniel Punkass hasn't gotten around to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of got myself into this, I wouldn't say bind, but I started out the Mars Edit Twitter account sort of having this little sort of snarky personality.
Yeah.
And then I decided that I didn't want to shift away from that. And I didn't want there to be sort of an ambiguity between the purposes of the Red Sweater account, the Mars Edit account, and the Daniel Punkass account. So actually, another thing that happens is people will tweet at me asking for support. And sometimes I'll just respond as me if I'm just sort of being casual about it. But often I will respond. Often what I'll do actually is I'll respond as me and then say, you know, please contact me at support@redsweater.com. So I'll concede the singular I, you know, in tweets from Daniel Punkass, but asking them to contact the support email address. And then when I'm responding as the support email representative, as, you know, Daniel Jalkut, customer service lead at Red Sweater Software, I'm always, of course, saying I there, you know.
Right.
It's just when I'm speaking in this very special, like on web pages and in press releases, et cetera, that... it's always we or us. And one of the reasons I like that is because, like I said, first of all, it just seems like it makes more sense for Red Sweater to not say I. But I've also always liked the idea that there won't need to be a plurality switch when one day I actually do have staff and employees. And I don't think it's dishonest to say we now, because I think of it not as meaning plural, but as meaning a special kind of... way you describe an entity instead of...
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. And I also like what you just said about maybe whether we choose I or we says something about where we want the company to be. So I don't envision Riverfold Software being more than me for the foreseeable future.
Right.
And you would love to have more employees. And so maybe that helps, you know, the we sort of makes sense too. And it projects that sort of that goal of having the company be bigger. And I don't know, I'm fine with the one person and I think I'll stick with I for a while. Either way, whatever, you know, you decide to do, I think the important thing is you don't, if you do we, you don't lose sight of what is good about I in terms of personal connection with a customer and also taking responsibility when things go wrong. When customers upset about something or the server breaks or the app crashes, I think it's important that they know that they're talking directly to someone that can help them and that's responsible for something versus they're sending email into the void and there's, you know, a outsourced team of people that may or may not escalate the problem. I think that is important to convey. Whatever word you use to convey that isn't quite as important.
You know, it's funny. You reminded me of a recent incident. One of the problems of having any kind of facade of, you know, larger than one is that people sometimes assume that you are a more gargantuan, you know, institution than you are. And they take liberties with their criticisms and perhaps with their expectations about how the company should behave.
Yeah.
So, I recently had an irate customer who was one of those guys that's just irate from minute zero. You know, it's like just out the door, you know, straight out the door. The first email is just livid and profanity and this is not how software should work. And
Oh, wow. Oh boy.
And so I said, you know, I'm very sorry about this. You know, I will do everything in my power to make this better, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I did, you know, that does not represent the sincerity or lack thereof. But anyway, point being, he says, sort of responds in a more humane tone to me, but saying, don't worry about it. It's not your fault. You know, it's not you. And something like, it's the idiots who made this software. Right.
Idiot programmer. Yeah.
So I know it's just you. You don't worry about it. This is just your job. You just have to answer support emails for Red Sweater. But the idiots who made this software should really find, you know, a better use of their talents. So at which point I have to sort of tactfully as possible explain to this guy that I am the idiot who made the software and I would still take full responsibility.
Wow, that's great. All right. Well, good talking to you again, everybody. Thanks for listening. And you can find us on Twitter at Corint. And feel free to send feedback or questions at feedback@corint.org.
Yep. We look forward to more questions. And if you haven't done it recently or at all, consider leaving us a review on iTunes and or a rating. Thanks again for listening. See you next week, Manton.
Bye.